Welcome, everyone, to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. It is co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. As always, we're grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we welcome back Richard Schrager. Schrager is the Per Bowen Professor of Law and the Joseph C. Carter Jr. Research Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. His scholarship focuses on the intersection of constitutional and local government law, federalism, urban policy, and the constitutional economic status of cities. He is interested, among other things, in how political communities are created and sustained. He also writes about law and religion, local recognition of same-sex marriage, and the history of anti-chain store movement. Schrager has published in the Harvard, Yale, Virginia, and Chicago reviews, among others. We'll talk about these topics and his book, City Power, Urban Governance in a Global Age. We'll also welcome Price Thomas to the show. Price is Director of Marketing and Communications at James Madison's Montpelier. He was instrumental in the launch of Montpelier's multi-million dollar and literally groundbreaking exhibition there, The Mere Distinction of Color, and in pioneering new education initiatives with local county schools. We'll discuss the exhibition, which builds on 17 years of archaeological excavation, oral history, and exploration of the culture of the enslaved community, and how Montpelier worked closely with the black community and descendants of slaves who worked and suffered on Madison's plantation. He's also a native of Charlottesville, and we'll talk about him, his life here growing up, his view on social justice today by looking to the past. You can see all our past shows on the station website, 947wpvc.org. And Nancy, are you there, my friend?
My brother, my sister, I am there. I'm here, and it's Saturday. What a surprise. I'm still here. I haven't left since last week. You're not taking my call, so I just decided to keep the phone on to make sure that you and I speak this weekend.
Thank goodness.
My plan.
So Roy Moore defeated... The other way around. Roy Moore's defeat. I know. I almost forgot about it, too. But I wanted to bring it up because it was just Tuesday. And I could not watch at all. I'm a news junkie. I couldn't watch anything until the morning. And I was blown away, jumping up for joy. And I must say, the black men and women saved us.
Yeah. As you just said, all of that. And I just want to add that I didn't realize until the midst of that night how much it seemed like November 8th all over again, you know, the election. I mean, it was just as gut-wrenching or, you know, as... I didn't want to turn on the television, as you said, until the morning. I didn't, even when I saw the pictures of the two candidates, because Roy Moore was on the right, was on the left side. Somehow, you know, that one is the first one you see. So I still initially thought, yeah, he won. You know, he pulled it out, and then I stared at the screen a little longer, and I couldn't believe it. I did not think he was going to win. Did you, Jones?
I'm so used to being disappointed lately. I didn't think he would. So no, I was really surprised.
Disappointed again.
Yeah. You may be up on the percentages, but what percentage of black voters do you think supported Jones?
The 80s, 90s. I'm going to say in the 90s.
96% of black voters, including 98% of African American women. And more voters came out to support this election, black voters, than did for Obama in 2012.
Yeah, you know, it does matter. It absolutely matters that we vote, and especially I know they. How could you not be scared and disturbed and upset about what might happen to your state with that guy with Roy Moore in? As a senator, I'm so glad everyone did their part. You know, obviously,
right? I think there's a strong movement on the ground there that did it, so it does matter. I'm glad you emphasized that, to vote and to organize. And I wanted to mention there was a really good Washington Post story this week, and I was thinking if black women saved us, white women and white men are going to kill us. Those that, you know, still believe the lies, it's getting very, very scary out there. And I just wanted to talk about Joy Reid a little bit. She is a reporter, for those of you who don't know, MSNBC, a really smart woman. And she said, about Trump. He has the dance of authoritarianism down. And step one, first thing you do is claim the investigation of you as a fraud by running, and it's being run by enemies of the state. You get your state-run media, which is Fox, to echo that to your base, whip them up into a frenzy against those investigating you, then get the state party, in this case the Republican Party, to echo that from the seat of government, saying the people investigating the president are they're themselves criminal. And it's a feedback loop and on and on. And then you call for the prosecution of your political enemy.
Yeah, I mean, right in that intersection is, as I'm sure you're aware, like the attacks on Mueller and now the Department of Justice and the FBI. I mean, all they're doing is dismantling, saying it's in tatters, whatever your terminology of the minute is, but all they're doing is making it clear that government institutions are not to be trusted, and only they are. You know, it's aggressive, and it is on my mind that no matter what, even if they don't replace Mueller or try to, that they just won't listen. You know, they just won't abide by the rule of law, whatever his findings are. They'll just.
Right. That is the very,
you know,
very, very, very
gaslight us.
Scary part. So,
yes, exactly.
I don't know. Take one person aside who watches Fox News. I don't know what to do. And make them watch Joy Reid or something. And speaking of Joy Reid, she's going to be in Charlottesville January 23rd. She's a rock star. And it's free at the Paramount at 6:30 p.m. January 23rd. So check that out. Go register online at the Paramount website.
Yeah. Look for all the... Look for the rainbows and unicorns floating above the Paramount. I guess that's how you'll know how to find it.
Yeah, she's fantastic. So I want to get to our first guest. Our first guest is Price Thomas. He is the Director of Marketing and Communications at James Madison's Montpelier. He was instrumental in the launch of Montpelier's multi-million-dollar exhibition, The Mere Distinction of Color, and in pioneering new education initiatives with local county schools right here in Charlottesville. So... Price, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I was going to go on and on, but I thought it would be better to hear from yourself. Tell us a little bit about, first, before we get to the exhibit, what it was like here growing up, and in the context of race and what's been going on now, what's changed? Tell us a little bit about your perspective on social justice and the things that have been going on in the country and in town.
Yeah, you know, Charlottesville is an interesting town, and I obviously have a soft spot for it. Was raised here, left to go to college, left to see the world, and then made it back. You know, I have a lot of family here. My parents are both teachers. I think what's really interesting in the context of what's going on recently is a lot of people are, you know, effusive in the fact that this is not Charlottesville. This is not the Charlottesville I know. This is not the Charlottesville where I was raised. And, you know, one could argue, and many people will argue, that you're just... It is Charlottesville. This is part of Charlottesville. It's just not the Charlottesville that is advertised as wineries and polo and the university, right? And all those things are great, right? But there is a part of Charlottesville that has been marginalized, that has been kicked to the curb. And when we think about August 12th and on, a lot of what happened is, you know, you get this a lot. People say, are you surprised by what happened on August 12th? Are you surprised by all that went down? And to be fair, the answer should always be yes, right? In 2017, someone driving a car down an alley, you know, and murdering a young woman should be surprising, right? So that, yes, is surprising. Am I surprised that people feel this way? Unfortunately, no, you know, I'm not. And I think that part of sort of that sociocultural education is understanding that Charlottesville's had, you know, what I would consider, let's call it a polite race issue for years. You know, and when you think about it, I grew up going to Jackson Via. I've seen the gentrification of Harris Road, of Longwood Drive, of an area that used to be a place where you didn't want to go in Charlottesville, which is now home to $250,000 townhouses. Where are all those people going? You know, and so part of, look, I mean, you know, part of the reality of it is facing that and saying that, look, there are great parts of Charlottesville. There's parts of Charlottesville that we love, and I'm obviously very fond of it. But, you know, there are other things that, unfortunately, have been going on for a long time that are just now recently being brought to light by the unfortunate events at the 12th.
Mm-hmm. You know, we talk a lot about Trump and the administration gaslighting us on many news events, things they said, etc. What you're describing, it just reminds me, growing up in Charlottesville, being, you know, I know it's been labeled the happiest city or something close to that in America or something. The fact that you see, you know, you've been living in a place different from that is, do you feel too that this is, you've been living in like a gaslighted environment, being told one thing and living another?
To a degree, of course, you know, and I mean, there's inequality all over Charlottesville when you talk about, you know, opportunity for jobs and education. I mean, you look at the way that students are tracked through the city schools, you know, and some of these kids, quite frankly, don't have a chance from Jump Street. You think about the inequality of housing and, you know, and then, you know, all of a sudden we have a vitriolic event and people are like, oh. You know, and they're like, oh my gosh, how could this happen in Charlottesville? And you've had people banging the drum for years who are saying, guys, this has been happening to me, to my community, to my family for years, you know, for years. But you know, that's not how we're advertised, right? And you said it, you know, the happiest place on earth or the best place to raise a family. And this is, you know, this is not an effort to chip away at the credibility of the town at all. Like I said, I love Charlottesville and, you know, without Bodos, we'd be nowhere. But I, you know, there is a reality to the city that these things do happen and these things go on, you know, and you can see all of a sudden people, oh, Wes is the problem, and he, look at all these things that he did. And I'm like, guys, he didn't invite white supremacists to Charlottesville. Like, you know, the man stood up for what he thought was right, and all of a sudden you have this rapid and violent white supremacy from inside and outside that's boiling up in town, you know, and then, you know, all of a sudden people are really defensive, and how could this be happening to me and to us? And the fact of the matter is it's been lying in wait for a really long time.
So do you feel like since August and we have such an attention deficit disorder, do you feel that white people are still engaged, are still trying to discuss this and own up to what they can do to make this better? What's your feeling about that?
You know,
I'm asking as a white person.
I think that, you know, it's very interesting for me. I found that it's almost as if a lot of people, and not everybody, and I'm my father's white, my wife is white, you know, but I find that there's a very interesting reaction to being called a racist versus, or a white supremacist, being called prejudiced versus doing something to help alleviate these social issues, right? People recoil, oh, I'm not a racist, don't call me a racist. You know, that's the worst thing you could possibly be called, right, is being called a racist, instead of working to try to alleviate, you know, the structures of white supremacy or racism, and understanding that even if you are not actively complicit in it, right, like, I don't, you know, have a Confederate flag, or I don't own slaves, or my family, you know, all this kind of nonsense, that, you know, you still benefit from the structure. So I think part of it is, how do we have that conversation in a way that is a little bit more elevated, right, and understanding that, look, you know, white privilege and things like this, you know, even if you're not quote unquote actively engaging in them, you still benefit from them. I mean, it's how this country was founded, you know, and it was founded on the basis of white privilege. And so just thinking about understanding that, you know, I think that there is a large, let me be very clear, there's a large group of people of all race, creed, color, sexual orientation that are actively trying to work towards solutions to this. I do believe that, you know, and I think that it's important to understand that, you know, we're not always the enemies of each other.
So you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking with Price Thomas, Director of Marketing Communications at James Madison's Montpelier. I wanted to get a little bit to the exhibit, kind of ties in with your role there as communications person and educator. You've brought the exhibit to kids and school kids, and I wanted to talk about that. I mean, seems like part of the solution is education. But a little bit about the exhibit first, called The Mere Distinction of Color. It built on 17 years of archaeological excavation, and it's really unique, I think, because you rely on the oral histories and the voices of people who are descendants of slaves there. And also, I just wanted to give a little quote about what the Mere Distinction of Color exhibition is, if I can find it. Hold on. Okay, so this is, I believe, Madison's words in 1787, in the heart of, you know, slave time. So we have seen the mere distinction of color made in the most enlightened period of time a ground of the most oppressive dominion over exercised by man over man. In other words, while things are going on that seem to be about, you know, pursuing liberty, he's got slaves and the whole country is in favor of slavery. So tell us a little bit about what you think the importance of this is, and from your perspective, and what you're doing with the kids here in Charlottesville.
Yeah, and that quote's really interesting. It was from Madison in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, and what it highlights is the interesting argument that happens around sort of the American founding and the story of the American founding, and it's how do we reconcile our American founders, you know, and you know, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights are documents that we still rely on 230 years later. And these men were slave owners, right? And so, you know, what we really are proud of is saying, look, it's not an either or, you know, it's an and. And it's about addressing the reality and the completeness of the American founding era. And the exhibition does an amazing job of that. You know, Kat Emhoff, our CEO, and Giles Morris, VP of Marketing, and Christian Coates, who project managed this whole exhibition, were very steadfast in addressing the reality of that, of the American founding. And so what we want to do through this exhibition is present, you know, a more holistic American story and then give people, you know, a different type of experience, one that gives agency to the enslaved. And we do that through, you know, using, like you said, archaeology and also documentary research to find oral histories, to find documentation. We have the names of the people who we were known enslaved, right? Because a lot of these exhibitions is about work. And we're taught slavery from a standpoint of it was hot. You know, my hands were tired and I didn't, you know, but these are things that we can't relate to, right? Like, we will never be enslaved. We will never have to work a field, right? But we could ostensibly be separated from our families, or we couldn't understand the feeling of losing a family member or not seeing a brother or sister. So we wanted to tell that story in a way that people could relate to. And as it pertains to education, we had an amazing opportunity through this Let 'Em Shine grant throughout Marl County to have 200 high school students, the 11th grades of Albemarle, Monticello, and Western Albemarle, to come to Montpelier for basically workshop-style learning about. Basically, what Let 'Em Shine does is it tasks the children with understanding public memory and memorialization. And so what we did is we brought in a bunch of scholars from across the country, you know, friends of Montpelier and folks who we work with, to give these kids an immersive look at memorialization from all angles. What does it look like from, you know, from a form standpoint? Who chooses the content? When? Why? How? What? So it was the first of its kind for a site like ours to invite that number of students to do something that was not, you know, rote lead museum-y, right? It wasn't walk through, get a tour, and leave. These students had the opportunity to talk to these scholars, to interact with our site, with folks, you know, generous friends from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and Brown Design, and all these people were invested in, you know, engaging with these students. And so really what we want to do at the end of it all is to engage the public, you know, and engage folks in our story, because it is our story. It's an American story, you know, and it all matters, you know, to where we land today.
We're talking with Price Thomas. We're going to go to a break, and after that break, we'll continue talking with the Director of Marketing and Communications of James Madison's Montpelier, and we're going to talk with Richard Schrager. He is the Research Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. We're going to talk about cities and city power. How much power do cities really have, and what should they have? We'll be right back after this. Welcome back, everyone, to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. We're talking with Price Thomas, Director of Marketing and Communications at James Madison's Montpelier. I want to talk a little bit more about the exhibit itself. I was there. It's really impressive because it is very experiential. Can you just talk a little bit about what people could expect and what's really intriguing about it once you're there?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The experience is something that we're very proud of and was very important to us and the designers, Proud Design and Fabrication out of Boston, and we had a lot of wonderful partners work on us with this. I think one of the most interesting parts, and obviously one of the most controversial parts, is that we have a video in the exhibition which is called The Legacies of Slavery, and it discusses basically the threads that we can pull from, you know, slavery and the founding of America to today. And what was really cool about this is we had this conversation with a couple different people, and we said, look, we want to talk about the legacies of slavery in 11 minutes. And one of the best stories about this is we talked to Ezra Edelman, who obviously has won an Oscar for his OJ work, and we said, here's what we want to do. What do you think? And he said, don't do that. He said, I wouldn't do it.
Really?
You know? And because it's impossible, right? It's such a big ask. And so we as an institution were thinking about, that's really good advice. How do we do this? So what we did is we convened a bunch of folks, you know, I mean, some of the smartest, you know, scholars and social justice activists and folks in this realm to come to Montpelier for a weekend to discuss this. How would you do this? You know, folks who are professors of African American studies from all over the country, you know, I mean, police captains, people who live in this world. How would you do this and what would you do? And what we left that with was an amazing new perspective on how to create this film. And so it has the voices of professors, it has the voices of Montpelier, it has the voices of descendants of slaves from Montpelier, trying to really talk about the important nuggets of relevant history. You know, so part of this exhibition, which we're really proud of, is the relevance, right? Because history at times can have a little bit of an issue there, and thinking about it was so long ago, especially for my generation, right? We're like, all right, great. Forever ago, names and dates, I don't care, right? But part of this is trying to understand, how do we connect the past to the present? How do we use the intellectual property that we have about Madison, about the Constitution, about the American founding, to help connect, you know, yesterday to today, in a way that now we can look forward and say, okay, you know, we have the foundation of understanding that we need to sort of strive to this, you know, American idealism, this theory that we have of America's the greatest place on earth, right? How do we get there? You know, and we need historical context to move that forward.
I think that's so important, because often a segment of the population will say, and I've heard it, slavery, it's over. I mean, let's move on. So I think exhibits like this are so important, because it really gives you an experience, you know, of what it was like. That what you talked about, the separation of families, people don't think about that. Like, some people might say, was James Madison really a taskmaster? Was he mean to his slaves? Oh, he was okay. Well, there's so much more going on there, right?
Yeah, you get all kind of questions. Well, you know, was he a nice slave owner, which is sort of like a hilarious oxymoron
right.
in and of itself, right?
But you're supposed to make us feel better. That's your job, right?
Right.
It's so upside down. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Right, yeah. But, you know, I think part of it is us as an institution being open to have those conversations, being like, look, you know, what we want to do is present the holistic story, you know, and give you more than what you came with, and thinking about and understanding, one, the founding era, but two, why it's relevant to today. And so, especially with Alamo County, when we think about, look, you can think about Montpelier as a memorial to James Madison, as a memorial to the 300 enslaved people who lived and worked at Montpelier, you know? And so giving these young people context about, look, you know, and I told the kids when I had the opportunity to speak with them that, you know, I don't expect you guys to leave as, you know, historians or, you know, like constitutional lawyers. If you do, that's great, right? But what I want to offer you is, you know, context for you guys who will be adults who have to live in town in this world. You have to work in this world. You have to understand, you know, sort of the reflective context of who you are and what you look like, and how that affects your way through the world. And all of, you know, this is not new. I think the best part about my generation is you think everything's new, mm-hmm. right? Everything to me, I had a great moment with my mom. I'm listening to a Kanye West song, and it's a sample of a Ray Charles track, and my mom's singing the song, and I'm like, why on earth? And, you know, she gave me that look of like, honey, this is, you know, nothing is new, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, I think what was really interesting about talking to some of these young people about Charlottesville is, you know, their minds are blown by it, and I'm like, guys, talk to your grandparents about the 60s. Talk to your grandparents about civil rights, you know, and understanding that this is all historically very, very relevant, you know, and so in understanding, you know, what happened, what we did, what we do, you know, is ultimately going to inform our future. And I think imparting that in young folks is extremely important.
I was really struck the way, Price, you described the students that you reached out to, these 200 students, and you got the scholars in there to talk to them, this whole immersive look, as you called it, to their, everyone's history, but in this case, their history. Was that approach your idea, and was it driven by the events was it affected by the events in, you know, in August?
Sure. So this county had this Let 'Em Shine grant, and I do have to give a public shout out to Angela Stokes and John Hobson from Albemarle County, who were instrumental in putting this together. What happened was they got this grant from the MacArthur Foundation, the National Writing Project, and basically what it stated was there was money to help students understand public memory and memorialization. And that was really it. And it's a massive task. And so they did a little bit of what Montpelier did in the exhibition, was they basically opened it up to you know, museum professionals around town. And so we had the opportunity to sit on a panel to talk with some folks. And the basic question was, how do we teach this, right? How do we as an education system, how do we as educators teach this in a way that's accurate, you know, as nonpartisan as possible, and also, you know, sort of fits into our curriculum, right? We have to blaze through all these things, and we have SATs and tests and a million other things. How do we do this justice, right? And so from that, you know, basically we said, look, we want you guys to come here, right? We have a power of place here at Montpelier. We want you to come here. You know, me going in and lecturing to a bunch of high school kids is not that powerful. Having them come out here to see the place, to talk with experts, to have a day, you know, to immerse themselves in this history is powerful. So from that, we built over the course of about 2 or 3 months, a plan over 2 days to host about, 100 kids a day. And we're lucky enough, like I said, to have wonderful partners and folks who we work with who flew in and worked these workshops with us. So it was a, it was a really cool experience and it was really cool to see the kids who, 17, 18 year old kids who are concerned with everything except history, right? To leave there, wide-eyed and to leave there, with more understanding and more context, to bring to, their sports team or their family or their dinner table or even this project was really cool. And so we're really proud of that. And that's what we want to do, right? We want to engage people at all levels, wherever they are, because like I said, it's our story, and it's our American story and it's not pretty, right? Pretty at all times. And we have to be brave enough to address that, and we have the intellectual property to do that, and it's just about making sure that we're willing to take that leap and be as honest as we can.
Do you feel like, let me ask you this. What effect do you feel that Trump is having on this issue of racism? What, as far as further dividing us?
Yeah, it's not pretty. I think that just from, words matter, and I say that because when we think about in the wake of Charlottesville, the whole comment about very fine people on both sides, right? Oh, well, he meant this and he meant that. Well, he said what he said, mm-hmm. And something like that works to be very divisive, it's tough, and it's tough, like I said, in a town that I love and in a place that I am comfortable in and that I've called home for a long time to for the first time as an adult feel a little bit of that unease, right? And to feel a little bit like, ooh, I'm not as isolated from it as I thought I might have been, because I grew up, went to Albemarle and sports and William and Mary and, you have these experiences, but you forget that no matter what you've done, me at 29 year old black, I look how I look, and to a lot of people, it's not, it's not necessarily particularly welcoming. And I understand that, but I think that part of the big issue when we think about Charlottesville, we think about, oh, it was about a statue or it's about history and all this knucklehead nonsense. I mean, at the end of the day, we boil it down to a ramp up in white supremacy, and we've seen that across the country, and that's not an accident, and that's not a coincidence, and that's coming straight from the top. I mean, these folks are emboldened by who's in charge, and it's super unfortunate that it's hit home for us, but this is happening all over the country, and we need to try as best we can to be a little less myopic and say, yeah, it's miserable what happened in Charlottesville, but this is national, and it's something that we all need to try and be, first of all, very cognizant of, and then we can take steps to work against it.
So in our final seconds here with you, Price, one question. Why do you think the turnout was so big in Alabama for Doug Jones among black voters? And what can we learn from that?
Yeah, it's that interesting, I guess you can call it silver lining. I mean, I think that it is about, black people really trying to it's interesting that you will never find a sort of more ownership than in a marginalized group in that sense of they understood the importance of themselves and their vote and their voice, and I actually had a white friend text me and she was just like, we can't get anything right. And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, white men and women have basically proven that we can't do this right. and we chuckle and it was glib, but I think it's very interesting when you think about something like, we talk about Let Them Shine, and if we're gonna tie this back to this program, we look at these young people. What happened in Alabama was an absolutely crystal clear picture that their voice matters, and that, voting matters. And I've read stories of people in Alabama spending hours driving people to the polls and, making sure that people were registered and people knew when to vote and where to vote and how to vote, and it's one insane the lengths that people had to go through, right, just to be able to exercise a constitutional right. But I think more than anything, there needs to be more of that in minority communities to say that, look, you can make a difference, and it's, you're not just throwing away your vote to then get sort of, stepped over by the institution. If you exercise your right, you can make a difference. And look, I hope that what happened in Alabama is a case study for the rest of the country to say that now's an important moment.
Right. Thank you so much, Price.
So
that's a
well
great,
said.
Great.
So nice to meet you.
Yeah, pleasure, guys. I really appreciate
it's
it.
A great. I just wanted to shout out again to the Mirror Distinction of Color. Will it be at Montpelier forever?
Or Mirror Distinction of Color is a permanent exhibition, so
excellent.
It will continue to be updated as we learn more, and as you know, history is additive, right? So time will continue to tick, and we'll continue to add, but it is not going anywhere.
Right, and they're doing more digging, I believe, the archaeology.
I know you guys talked to Matt, who is the most excitable and excited man in the entire world. He's an absolute treasure. So yeah, yeah, he will continue the work in earnest, and we'll have. You know, more for you. Each time you come, you'll find something new.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Price Thomas of James Madison's Montpelier. Nancy, do you you have some news?
I did. It's such a tragedy and part of it, but still, he leaves and I'm smiling for some reason. I don't know why. He said such smart things. Yes, I do. I have a news of note. It's an imported news of note, actually.
Excellent.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if it is.
After repeated attempts to get Trump to reverse his decision on pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Accord, brokered by you know who, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled his Make Our Planet Great Again grants this week. He's awarded 13 of his 18 initial grants, climate grants, to U.S. based scientists, so that they can relocate to France because France believes in science, essentially. You know,
yes.
There you go. It is a scattering of applause. The winning researchers come from Princeton and Stanford and Harvard, among others, and he's welcomed these our scientists to settle in and develop projects in rich French and European research because they are fully committed to the issue and realize that the work is essential, as opposed to, as you would probably call him our orange sock puppet, or maybe you wouldn't, but I just did.
Orange
Hitler.
Who is
fine with America's brain drain.
Right.
You know, I remember, I'm sure you did, you know, we used to be the country that scientists fled to when they couldn't do their work at home, or the rescued intellectuals from oppressive regimes, and...
Yeah, I did hear about that. Good for them.
What do you got?
I have that. Thursday, another Democrat endorsed articles of impeachment. That's Democrat Carol Shea Porter of New Hampshire. She's the latest to join the effort. At least 17 communities are now on record calling for impeachment proceedings. I just hope Mueller gets the job done before any more damage is done. I think we say that every week.
Yeah, well, it is. As I've said once before, many times before, I don't care that the man Trump hasn't passed a piece of legislation, though apparently he's about to, but he's done so much damage. I just thought our argument doesn't make me feel any better. He's done so much.
I know. We didn't even talk about net neutrality, but I think you can roll that back eventually. It's just what I'm praying for. However, let's talk cities. Let's talk law. Let's talk constitution. Our next guest is Richard Schrager. He is the Per Bowen Professor of Law and the Joseph C. Carter Jr. Research Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. His scholarship focuses on the intersection of constitutional and local government law, federalism, urban policy, and the constitutional and economic status of cities. He's very interested in how political communities are created and sustained. He also writes about law and religion, local recognition of same-sex marriage, and the history of the anti-chain storm movement. He's very published. He's written a ton, as I mentioned. And we're also going to talk about his book, City Power, Urban Governance in a Global Age. So welcome, Richard Schrager.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ellen. And Nancy, and great to meet you, Price. Terrific comments this morning.
I love like the intersection of our guests together. I feel like we should have a dinner party sometime with everybody. Nancy and I, we can leave and just be, you know, like, I don't know, some guy used to do that. Throw a party and then let everyone else have a good time. So lay out the problem for us. What are the restrictions constitutionally that cities face in your eyes?
So this is obviously a topic near and dear to my heart, and I can give you an example from what we've been talking about, which is the Charlottesville example in the Commonwealth, and we've seen this firsthand in this community, which is that there is a state law that says that local governments cannot take down Confederate monuments that have been put up already. Now there's some ways to interpret that law. And we can talk about that, in which Charlottesville would have a right to do so. But the fact of the matter is, we've talked a lot about what Charlottesville can do as a city to promote racial justice. But what we sometimes forget is that the General Assembly asserts a great deal of power over what cities can do, Charlottesville and other cities. And one example is the restriction on removing statues of various kinds, and the Lee and the Jackson statue are two of those. Another example is the Commonwealth's open carry law, which allows folks to carry guns. And both of those laws are very restrictive on local power, and there are many more. Lots of localities want to do lots of things. An example would be a local minimum wage law, for example, or a local inclusionary housing law is another example. And the Commonwealth and states across the country are very aggressive at restricting those cities' capabilities.
So we're going to go to a hard break. We're going to be right back with Richard Schrager. He's a professor of law at the University's School of Law. We're going to talk about a lot of things, including cities and maybe the anti-chain law or writings that you've had, anti-chain store. So we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. I'm Ellen Daniels, and I'm here with my co-host, Nancy Lawrence. We've been speaking with Price Thomas, but most recently with Richard Schrager, professor of law at the University of Virginia. So go ahead, Nance.
Oh, sure. Richard, I was wondering that I did not realize this, but I know you are an expert in this. How does the Constitution itself, the way it's structured or written the laws, favor rural over urban voters and make the, you know, cities themselves weak inherently?
Yeah, so it's a great question. First of all, just the United States Constitution doesn't recognize cities at all. What it recognizes is states, and the Supreme Court has said that states get to exercise plenary power over their cities, which means a state can govern the cities in the way that it wants. Now, some states, in their own state constitutions and in their state statutes, give cities some degree of autonomy and authority to pass certain kinds of legislation. But at the end of the day, there's no constitutional protection for cities. The other part of the U.S. Constitution that's problematic is that it favors rural, relatively non-urban states. That's because the U.S. Senate is designed in such a way that it gives disproportionate voting power to rural states over urban ones. So remember, Wyoming gets the same number of votes in the Senate as California does. These are two very different populations, and the urban states then are disadvantaged by that.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. So, Richard, what can cities do in light of these problems?
Oh, it's a tough question. You know, what we are seeing throughout the country right now, and it's been really in the last 5 years or so, a little longer than that, is states coming out aggressively to preempt, and preempt is a kind of a legal term, but to preempt local legislation in lots of areas. So local anti-discrimination law, local minimum wage laws, local sanctuary city policies, all of those are subject to legislative override. And we see this in Florida, Texas, Arizona, Michigan, Virginia is a state also. So all across the country, that's what we're seeing. What cities are doing is they're litigating some of these cases to assert their own authority, but they don't have a great deal of legal basis to prevent some of this override. So what has to happen is they have to lobby in the state legislature. And increasingly, they're spending a lot of time, cities across the country are spending a lot of time trying to prevent dangerous and damaging incursions into their own local authority in various areas. But this is a political fight. And one of the things that people need to be aware of is that local power can't be taken for granted. And if you are in particularly in a progressive city and you're faced with a hostile state legislature, you need allies to fight that political fight.
You know, I was wondering, there's like roughly 81% of the population that is considered urban. So why is there such hostility towards cities having a say in their individual, you know, in their residents' lives.
Yeah, so the urbanization numbers can be a little misleading, because when we talk about urban, we're also talking often about suburban kinds of communities too. We're talking about metropolitan areas. So lots of people live in extended metropolitan areas for sure. But I think what we've seen and what we saw in the last presidential election was an urban-rural split that we had not thought still existed, precisely because, Nancy, the number that you cite there. But that urban-rural split is real. You see that in the maps, the electoral maps, where you have all kinds of red everywhere except little dots of blue on the coasts and in the cities. And so the rural-urban split continues to be real, despite the fact that lots of people now live at least attached to a metropolitan area or in suburban jurisdictions. The reason for the hostility is complicated, but I think there's a long-running hostility towards urban places, and it goes back to Thomas Jefferson, who thought that cities were dangerous to the Republic. And it continues all the way through, especially in the as the Industrial Revolution comes about, as industrial cities start to grow and gain power, there is hostility to that. And some of that is hostility to ethnic and racial minorities asserting power, and some of it's just fear of the big city. And we see that in the rhetoric of Donald Trump, for example. He has this image, ironically, he made all his money in New York City, but he has this image of the city as a dangerous, horrible ethnic and racial mass, and he's opposed to that, and it evokes images that we've had for a long time in this country.
So, kind of along those lines, how do you think local government or decentralization of power can support social liberties and religious liberty?
So, I think progressives for a long time have looked to the central government for protection of these kinds of things. And the New Deal is an example of that. The civil rights struggle, which results in Brown versus Board and the civil rights laws. Those are all incredibly important national events. And they emit from the U.S. Congress and from the center. But I think what sometimes progressives overlook is the fact that local communities, cities in particular, are fruitful places for adopting similar laws. And we should think in terms of protecting that kind of authority and power. A good example is just anti-discrimination laws for LGBTQ folks. Cities are on the forefront of that. Minimum wage laws, cities are on the forefront of that. Same-sex marriage, cities, San Francisco is the great example. Cities were on the forefront of that. So we have to remember that decentralized authority can be progressive, too. It's not just regressive. Certainly, in the civil rights era, states were recalcitrant in many ways and needed to be reined in during the Jim Crow era. But I think cities can be very fruitful places for lots of social and economic liberties.
How different is this power struggle from state to state? I'm aware of Texas and the immigration issue and North Carolina, but I'm sure you're, you know, aware of others that are egregious as well.
Yeah, so it's all across the country. So Florida, for example, wants to pass just what we call blanket preemption legislation, which would just say that cities can't regulate anything having to do with business. Or anything having to do with property, for example. Michigan has similar laws. North Carolina, as you mentioned, we see it across the country. And it's not just a red state, blue city phenomenon. That is, it's not just in states where you have Republican state legislatures and Democratic city councils. It's also in states like New York, where there's the same parties in power essentially at the state level and at the city level, but the state is hostile to lots of things that, say, Bill de Blasio wants to do in New York, and we see that with the fights that he's had with with Governor Cuomo. So it's not, it's really structural. That is, states, state legislatures think that they are representing local constituents, and they are, because they're voted by local constituents, and they don't see any reason to be restrained when they assert regulations that affect cities.
Do you think the, well, it looks like the GOP tax cut bill that will seemingly pass, do you feel that too has an anti-urban bias?
Yes, well, yeah. Certainly. So the state, and I don't know what's, I haven't seen what the final version looks like, but the state and local...
They're still scribbling it in the margins, Richard, come on.
There is no final version. Nobody's
exactly.
seen the final version, right? You know, this is this, and it's been widely reported, I think it's probably right, is that this is an effort, the sort of the getting rid of the deduction for state and local taxes or local property taxes or reducing that, is in some ways a way to penalize higher tax states and higher tax localities. And when you look at the map, what it does is it seems to penalize those states that tend to vote Democratic and that have large cities in them, large metropolitan areas that have some higher value property, and maybe those places that invest more in their local services, and that's part of an agenda that is a low tax, low government agenda, and that's often incompatible with what urban areas need and what urban areas seek. So there's a very big difference between what governing needs a city has and what governing needs a rural community or a suburban community has. If you just look around in any given city, the number of street lights and sidewalks and stop signs and all the things that cities require, they need more support for that, and they need the ability to tax, and they need the ability to have support for that taxing power. And the state legislatures and the U.S. Congress now are very hostile to that agenda.
Do you think there's any hope, or not hope, but are there any rulings from the Supreme Court that can help or not, or do the opposite, actually?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court can't save us on this one.
Right.
The generally... their rulings have reaffirmed that states can do what they want with their cities. There's sometimes a few inklings of a possibility that you could have some kind of right of local self-government embedded, but that's really too far afield for the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think all of this has to happen at the state level.
So what's in your opinion, the best way to affect policy or to change some of this?
Vote.
Right. Support the candidates
vote. And also, you know, and this is a good example for, we were talking about Charlottesville and what Charlottesville needs to do. It's fine to focus, I think it's important, frankly, to focus on local elections and what local people can do and get those folks, hold those people accountable for their actions and get them to adopt and embrace progressive policies and policies that are important to the local community. It's equally as important to do that at the state level and the national level, and more at the state level, at least for our immediate purposes, which is you've got to go down there to the General Assembly and tell those folks that you would like Charlottesville to have the authority to do things that right now they're not allowed to do. And that's really important, and we don't focus on that as much as we should because we think, oh, the city needs to improve, or we need different leaders in the city, or we need to just fix things in our own backyard. But I think the important thing is to know that the state, the Commonwealth here in Virginia, the state exercises enormous power over what localities can do and what cities can do, and that's going to have more repercussions. So vote and lobby and put pressure on your state legislatures.
Thank you so much. Richard Schrager is the Per Bowen Professor of Law and the Joseph C. Carter Jr. Research Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me again. Sorry it took so long to get here.
That's okay.
It's always a pleasure.
Okay. We'll persist again.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So, Nancy.
Ellen, I feel badly. You didn't get to ask about the retail.
This is for us.
I know.
Okay. What didn't I get to ask?
You didn't get to ask Richard about the retail chain.
I know.
The chain store thing. Movement.
He's still here.
I'll give you 30 seconds on the chain store.
Give us 30 seconds.
In the 20s and 30s, there was an anti-chain store movement in this country. Okay. Now, some of it was a little reactionary, so we have to be careful about this. But this was Louis Brandeis was part of this too, Justice of the Supreme Court, famous people's lawyer. And it was an assertion of local economic autonomy and independence. And I think that goes together with city power too, which is, we have lots of transnational corporations, right, who assert lots of power in our society. And one of the things that can counter that is trying to revive a kind of local economic democracy. And that was what the anti-chain store movement was in part about. It, of course, didn't succeed. We have chain stores everywhere. But we forget that there was such a movement in the 20s and 30s. And I'm not suggesting that we can go backwards and get rid of chain stores. I don't think that's a great idea anyway, but I do think that we can think more collectively about what our economic system looks like and why we have such a disparity between the rich and the poor. And some of the history of the anti-chain store movement is available to invoke in that regard.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks, Nance, for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for that chance, Nancy.
Important like that.
Oh, yeah. And City Power, that's the name of the book. Just to plug the book.
City Power, Urban Governance in a Global Age by Richard Schrager. Available
in
books.
Into the palate cleanser?
Available in bookstores everywhere.
Yeah, and buy it from it from the independent bookstores, not necessarily from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, though it's there too, and I know it's very easy to do.
Okay. Oh.
Thanks. So let me do this, Nance. Ready?
Yeah.
It's the palate cleanser. Okay.
And audio. Okay. So I need you, though, for my palate cleanser. It's like a $25,000 pyramid, you know, the game show.
Is it a scheme?
I'm going to give you some varieties of something, and you are going to tell me what these are varieties of.
Okay.
Stop me at any time.
Fun.
Okay. 30 seconds on the clock. No, okay. Okay, here they are. The dog snout, pink sparkle, red royal limber twig, Dr. Harvey, Esopus Spitzenberg, Duchess of Oldenburg. I'm giving them away, right?
Wait, when do you want me to chime in?
Do you know what they are?
Beer.
No.
Okay.
I wish I had a buzzer. I need your audio. Okay.
Right.
Maybe this will
any,
do it. Lord
any guess
Hinsman?
From the panel here? Any guesses from the panel?
Oh, yeah.
I got absolutely nothing.
Whoa. That was like the random list.
I think it's trees.
No,
is it shrubbery?
No, it's legit. Hey. Anyway.
Is it shrubs?
Okay. No. Rusty coat? Pixie crunch? No. Okay. They are all names of apples. I kid you not.
Oh, the twig. Wow. You said twig, and I thought trees.
Dr.
Nice.
Harvey is an apple.
Wow.
So is Lord Hindlip. So go to your Whole Foods after this, after I shut up, and see if I carry any of these things.
I almost spent $6 on like two apples at Whole Foods, and then I made them put them back, but they looked amazing.
All right, what do you got if I left you any time?
Yeah, we got a little time here. This week in New Zealand, researchers found the remains of a giant prehistoric penguin. Can you believe it? 5'10 and 220 pounds.
Strapping fellow.
And,
or woman, excuse me.
I mean, when you compare this to the tallest penguin now, the emperor penguin is only 47 inches. That's pretty big.
Yeah. Blimey.
I mean, it's not as good as yours, but I love penguins, and this one caught my eye. And the little blue penguin that is alive these days is the smallest type, and it's only 33 inches high. So 5'10", that's a pretty big penguin.
It's massive.
Crickets. So...
Let's name it Pixie Crunch. Shut up. That was dumb. Okay, go ahead.
No. Okay, so... I think we're almost out of time. Just wanted to thank our guests, Price Thomas.
Yes.
Thanks for sticking around,
Absolutely.
Price, and Richard Schrager. I want to get pictures, so don't leave. we will be back at some point. Our theme music is brought to you by Springtide in Japan. Thanks again to the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. So please, that would be a great thing to do. Please do it. Anything else, Nance?
No.
All right. Thanks, Nance.
Thank you.
See you later.